Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Path to Zero is on the road in Austin, and where we have a great opportunity to visit in person with one of the nation's leading experts in CCS, carbon capture and storage. Dr. Tip Meckel is a senior research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. In his work with the Bureau's Gulf Coast Carbon Center, Dr. Meckel is leading several research projects to capture CO2, store it deep underground in geologic formations to permanently isolate it from the atmosphere. He was recently appointed to a White House task force on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Dr. Meckel, thanks for joining us and welcome to Path to Zero.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Looking forward to talking about so many things, but let's get right into your research. We're really going to talk about carbon. We're going to talk about putting carbon back into the ground where it originally came from. And just start by talking to us about the carbon cycle, maybe what happens when CO2 molecules leap into the atmosphere. So start with that.
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, the general public is probably aware that there's a carbon cycle out there, but what they're probably not as aware of is that there are multiple reservoirs for the carbon. So we have carbon that's in the deep earth, we have carbon that's in the biosphere, we call it, we have carbon in the hydrosphere, in the waters, in the earth's surface, we have carbon in the atmosphere. So we have all these spheres that the carbon resides in, and it's there for different amounts of time, and it's there in different masses, total masses. So in the earth, in the geosphere, there's an immense amount of carbon, but it's locked up deep in the earth for millions of years in general. And so when we produce, say, hydrocarbons, we're moving, say, that carbon from the geosphere up into the surface, and if we burn it, we'll put it into the atmosphere. And from the atmosphere, it doesn't just stay there. It moves into the hydrosphere, into the waters, the surface waters. The oceans absorb a lot of carbon that's emitted into the atmosphere, as much as 30%. And then from there, it can even go into the biosphere. So you could be absorbing it into trees and plants, as we know. So it's actually not just one cycle. It's actually moving between these different reservoirs through time. And so the Earth handles carbon very efficiently through geologic time, but it all happens with the kinetics of physics, right? So like you can only change the matter from one form to another through kinetics. And so it can only happen at a certain pace. So let's just put it to you this way. There are, in a high school experiment, there'd be reactants and products, right? You'd stick two reactants into a test tube and you'd make a product. Well, all of the rate at which you can make the product is defined by the kinetics of that reaction, right? And you can enhance it by adding temperature or some catalyst. And we learned how to do that with a lot of reactions. But ultimately, the reaction is hindered by the amount of reactants it has. And so if there's excess reactants, they end up as excess, right? So you can actually run the reaction to completion and have excess reactants. And so what I'm really trying to point out is that when we emit carbon, say, through a combustion process, it enters the atmosphere and it could be there for 200 years, but it could also move into the oceans. It could move into the biosphere, into the plants, and it could move back and forth over time. But that molecule in the atmosphere for 200 years, those other processes don't work at, you know, they work at slow timescales. So what we're seeing now is an excess of reactants in the atmosphere and even in the oceans.
And that really is the issue, right? Carbon, we used to never talk about carbon being the enemy, and now
right.
Carbon is the only enemy, right? And our goal is to have zero carbon.
Right, and so... From my perspective, you know, when I was younger, there was talk about ozone. You know, ozone hole was a big issue for the environment at the time, and that was for CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons that are used in refrigerants. And so because of the issue, you know, new policies were put in place on CFCs, and we don't really talk about that issue anymore. In fact,
problem's largely been solved.
We solved it.
Yeah.
And I would say the same is largely true for sulfur and nitrogen oxide. So SOx and NOx emissions from combustion were contributing to acid rain. And in large part, you know, there were some big effects on forests in New England and other places that were quite visible. And again, a policy implementation of cap and trade actually has completely eliminated that problem. And so now it's just we're moving to another element, another molecule, right?
Well, I know your work is really around carbon capture and storage.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Right. So one of the ways to reduce emissions from industrial sources going into the atmosphere, and I say industrial sources because we know that there are natural emissions from volcanoes or from plants as they decay, but to reduce them from the from the industrial processes, which actually ends up being a large component of new introductions into the atmosphere, you can capture it. So that sounds complex, but essentially you're taking an emissions stream. So the easiest one for people to visualize would be, you know, the tailpipe on their car. But maybe the second most easily visualized is sort of what people call the smokestacks coming out of factories. But they're generally not smoke, particulate matter coming out. It's water vapor that's really making the clouds coming out. And in there is CO2. And so really what we're saying is you take that emissions stream and you redirect it into essentially a capture facility. And then you strip out the CO2, which can be at different concentrations for different processes. And you concentrate it into an almost pure form. And then you can either utilize it for different products or activities like enhanced oil recovery, or you can essentially store it or dispose of it in the deep subsurface to achieve benefits to the atmosphere.
So you need to capture it.
You need to capture it.
You can store it.
You can.
You store it in places deep away.
Right.
The oceans, outer space. I mean, we talk about all those things. Or you can also find ways to creatively use it, right?
Right, and that's an exciting area in not part of my research, but I have heard a lot of very creative ideas for how we might utilize CO2 in industrial processes to make products as opposed to just treating it as essentially a waste product and disposing of it. One of the big challenges is, aside from enhanced oil recovery, which uses the most CO2 out there, the second largest is beverages, and it's not very much. And then beyond that, it's really small amounts. But I believe that there's a lot of creativity coming in this area. I just saw this week that companies like Walmart are considering looking at how to make fibers for clothing and textiles out of CO2 molecules. So essentially using it as feedstock for essentially a synthetic fibers. And so that stuff's very exciting, but it's not going to take up a whole lot of CO2 use. So we're still probably always going to need a disposal part of that scenario.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. It's fascinating as that changes so rapidly. All right, you really represent the Gulf Coast Carbon Center, right? Tell us more about the Gulf Coast Carbon Center, what they do, and
right. So I refer to it as the center, but the Gulf Coast Carbon Center was established about 20 years ago at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, specifically with the idea of trying to work on industrial deployment of carbon capture and storage, but mostly from the storage side. So being a subsurface expertise at the Bureau of Economic Geology, we were focused almost entirely on the subsurface. And so actually about, I think it's almost 18 years ago, I attended my first CO2 conference, which was actually by the Society of Petroleum Engineers in Galveston. And that led to me being hired into the group to work on the geologic side of storage. And since then, we've grown to be the largest CO2 storage research group in the United States and probably one of the largest in the world as well. So we focus entirely on the subsurface, but our Department of Chemical Engineering focuses on capture and our petroleum engineering groups focus on wells and pipelines. So we've got dozens of people working on this full time now.
And carbon capture and storage is very much a Gulf Coast thing if we think about it in terms of the U.S. or North America or maybe the world, right?
Right.
You got the facilities, you've got the pipelines, you really have the infrastructure to deal with carbon, right?
And that's a really good point. So in the United States, the largest geographies of emissions are the Ohio River Valley, where we have a lot of coal-fired electric utilities and other activities. But the second largest concentration of emissions is between New Orleans and, say, Corpus Christi. So the Gulf Coast is actually, if you took it as its own entity, it's an extremely large producer of CO2 alone. So Texas produces more CO2 than any other state. That's mostly because it's a very it's a state that does a lot of manufacturing, a lot of petrochemical refining. We export a lot of products. So we have more carbon emissions in the state of Texas than the next two states combined. And so, but that means that a lot of our emissions are concentrated in specific areas like the Mississippi River Valley, like over in Beaumont Port Arthur or the Houston Ship Channel, places where industry naturally started their processes and then leveraged the co-location. So now we can capture from multiple facilities in the same geography, and that leads to economies of scale. So it makes great sense to do this in the Gulf Coast. And we're also blessed with one of the most incredible geologies in the Gulf of Mexico basin for storage in the world.
For storing it. Yeah. Interesting. And so the knock on carbon capture has been such low concentrations, kind of an inefficient process,
right.
But that's more around direct air capture,
right.
Which is just one technique y'all are studying, right? Anything that you just see so much promise for removing the carbon?
Yeah, so a phrase I use a lot is not all carbon emissions are created equal. So if you're working at an ethanol facility, say corn ethanol, corn distillation into ethanol in the Midwest, the CO2 that comes off that process of fermentation is very pure. And so it's a very cheap way to access CO2. So you've seen a lot of successful projects develop in Illinois and other parts of the Midwest. There are big plans to work on all of the ethanol facilities distributed throughout the Midwest. And as you move into other sectors, you'll find that the CO2 capture cost is different. So that one of the next best stops for cheap, high-volume CO2 is actually in natural gas processing. So when we remove methane from the subsurface, often it'll have a small component of CO2 associated with it. And so it needs to be stripped out for the shipping specifications for methane in the pipelines. And so they'll strip it out, and currently you vent it. But that CO2 is also very pure, and it's built into the industrial process. So you don't have to add anything new. It has to be there anyway. So natural gas processing is really attractive. And then the downstream part of natural gas becomes very interesting, because as you get into the international shipment of, say, liquefied natural gas, you bring that methane to a facility, you still take out the last little bit of CO2, so that it's essentially pure, so you can put it into LNG, so you refrigerate it and compress it. So you've got a little stream of CO2 there, but then you've got a lot of CO2 coming off of the power trains that are doing all the compression for the LNG. And so one of the areas that's growing really rapidly in CCS is not the post-combustion electric utility capture. It's capture from industrial processes like gas processing, like LNG. And we're seeing companies in the Gulf Coast actively taking, they're embedding CCS projects in their financial development decisions for developing LNG in the United States. And part of that is that the international market is demanding a greener LNG product. Some of that has to do with fugitive emissions in the source areas, but a lot of it also has to do with the CO2 footprint of the LNG. And so the Gulf Coast being the largest LNG, you know, exporter in the United States, you'll see a lot of those facilities developing carbon capture units associated with them, because it's an easy place to work on it. We do have examples of capture from post-combustion electric utilities. It's just much more expensive to get that CO2. So we're going to start with the easy stuff, ethanol, hydrogen, methane, and we're going to work our way up into the more complex things like combustion. And eventually, we'll go after the really hard things like steel and cement, which really you cannot decarbonize without carbon capture and storage. It's very difficult to imagine that. But that's another exciting utilization opportunity. In cements, they're actually realizing that if you reintroduce some of the CO2 back into the cement in the curing process, there are indications that you might be able to get the cement to cure faster and actually be stronger by incorporating a little bit of CO2. So there's another utilization opportunity. The chemists, as I say, are just getting going on this, but there's a lot of opportunity to work with different sources of CO2. It's not all just one thing.
And again, almost all of the capture, you're short of a few industrial processes or enhanced oil recovery in the oil patch. The rest of that captured carbon is generally sent away somewhere, right?
Right. And that's just simply a volumetrics or a mass thing. If you can use 10% of it for products and development, that's great. But the simple facts are we have 90% that can't find a home. And so right now, the smart thing to do is to put it under the ground, and we have incentives for wanting to do that. It's a lot. One way to think about it is sort of how we handle solid waste. Early days, you just kind of put it wherever, right? You just threw it out the window and whatever. And then we evolved away from that. But then the next smartest thing was, okay, let's just go concentrate it in a landfill, right? And we still do a lot of landfilling. And then we started into the recycling bit to avoid having to landfill so much. So we're going to see the same thing in CO2. We're going to start with landfilling, which is subsurface storage, but we're going to evolve into a more recycled, more product-driven uses of it. So CCS, as it exists today, is not what it will look like in 30 or 50 years. It will be much more complex. But right now, it's the biggest hammer in the toolbox for reducing significant amounts of industrial emissions in a time frame that we really care about. And so without it, it's going to be more expensive to reduce carbon. The other, there's a great starting point for a lot of carbon conversations and carbon reduction conversations comes from sort of this, what we call the rainbow diagram, which is you've got your trajectory of what CO2 emissions would be, sort of business as usual, all things being the same. And then you can start to cut out these wedges for different activities. So you could have an efficiency wedge, and you could say, oh, well, if we got more efficient on buildings and energy use, we would reduce our carbon intensity. And then you could imagine fuel switching as part of efficiency. So as we move from, say, displacing a gas turbine with, say, a renewable source, that would move it down a little bit more. But you would also have all these other wedges. You could have nuclear as part of the wedge. CCS is as another wedge. And in those diagrams, mostly we consider CCS to only really be addressing about 20 to 30% of our total needs for carbon reduction. So I don't think this is necessary. It's not a silver bullet that gets you where you need to go, but it actually lets you do things very quickly at scales that really matter while all these other things get more sophisticated and developed so that we can actually get those wedges to grow also. We need all those things to get to the goals.
For sure. Love to repeat that. We need all of these things to get to the goals, for sure. Yeah. You know, one of the things I read about often is finding ways to store carbon in the built environment.
Right.
We talk about all industrial, right, agricultural, transportation, power gen. And I'm always fascinated, and I think that's one of the references you make about perhaps modern buildings being able to absorb carbon themselves, much like a tree.
Yeah, I mean, you can think of the first level would be just the materials, right? Can you use materials that would essentially isolate carbon, you know, from the rest, all those other spheres I talked about.
Concrete or asphalt, maybe a way to lock it in for perpetuity, right?
And actually, there's a really great potential driver there, that is, if you had procurement requirements that gave precedent to, say, a cement that would be used in all the built environment, that would essentially be what we might deem a low carbon cement, or a cement that uses CO2 in its curing. You could create a driver for expanding on that, right? Another way to think about the built environment, again, it's not my specialty, but a lot of people think, well, you could basically be using other materials that would hold the carbon. For, you know, if your building's going to last 100 years, then it's 100 years. And that matters. That's a time scale that matters to us. So where it gets a little hazier is in the other offsets, where you talk about agricultural offsets or forest offsets, because those things are harder to, in my mind, to necessarily establish the long-term benefit, because some of those things can come and go from those different spheres that I was talking about. So, you know, you could have a forest that's got generating offsets for 50 years, but then later a landowner clears the forest and those credits just disappear. And so to me, I like to use the phrase that carbon capture and storage is like the AAA rated carbon offset, because it's measurable, it's big quantities, and it's permanent. We know we can get it to the right environment. It'll stay there for geologic periods of time.
Talk to us about the physical mechanics of capturing carbon. Do you do it with, is it a process? Do you use it with filter media? Yeah. How do you do it?
It's interesting you say filter, because somebody asked me recently, like, what's a really simple analog that I could use to describe this? And I said, it's kind of like your coffee filter, honestly, but it's not. Let me describe it to you this way. So caffeine is in a bean that's in fairly low concentration. And so to get it to higher concentration, we grind up the bean, expose more surface area to hot liquids, and we strip out the caffeine. And so that's one way to concentrate an element or a compound or a molecule. And so with CO2 emissions, you've got a gas that might be nitrogen, CO2, other species, other molecules in there, but it's a gas phase. So you run the gas up through what's called a stripper tower, and there's a liquid dripping from the top, and there's gas coming up from the bottom. And as they interact, and there's a filter in there that helps maximize that interaction, the liquid then falls to the bottom, but it's absorbed all the CO2 out. And so that's a process that we've been using for 50 years. It's very effective. And then you've got this really concentrated liquid with CO2 in it at the bottom of your facility. So you move it over that's the absorption tower. You move it over to your stripper tower and you heat it up, and it liberates the CO2 and the liquid that can then be recycled to use again in more capture.
And you capture that.
So now you've got that CO2 in a pure form, because you don't really want the extras in there. If there's other things in the CO2, you really want just the CO2. So those amines, that's the liquid, are used to pull just the CO2 out. And then once you have it in a concentrated form, you can compress it into what's called essentially a dense phase liquid. So it goes from a CO2, a gas like you would exhale. If you compress it enough, it'll become a liquid. And so that liquid is easier to transport, say, via pipeline, which we've done. There are thousands of miles of CO2 pipeline in the United States, and we've been moving it by pipeline for 50 years. So understanding how to move it is quite straightforward, but you have to compress it into this liquid form. And then when we get it to our injection wellheads, we might add just a little more pressure to get it to go down the well and push into the rock formations. And so as it moves into the rock formations, it'll displace the resident brine in there, and then it'll remain trapped in the rock formation, just like oil or gas would in a natural process.
Any dangers maybe in putting it into the earth? Do we believe that's a safe process?
Right. So I think the very first thing to realize is, as I mentioned at the top, CO2 is natural in all of our systems, in the geosphere, in the biosphere. So CO2 is not really, it's not really foreign to these environments. Now, what we're trying to do is put it into these large concentrated pools, essentially like a hydrocarbon pool might be in the subsurface. And one of the properties of dense phase CO2 in the subsurface is it's less dense than the resident brine liquid, salty water. And so it wants to rise up in the subsurface. And this is true of hydrocarbons as well. So hydrocarbons are less dense than the brine, so they tend to migrate vertically, and they'll find places where they can accumulate in very large quantities that we can produce. And so as geologists, we're just looking for the same types of environments where we can introduce liquid CO2, let it migrate and accumulate in that same kind of scenario. And so the biggest risk that's been identified is for it to migrate vertically further up into the shallow subsurface, because when we're injecting it, it's down, it could be a mile, it could be 2 miles beneath the Earth's surface. And so really, it's only the upper few hundred feet, or maybe 500 feet, that's got potable sources of drinking water. So the main regulatory requirement for permitting a CO2 injection well is to keep it from migrating up into the near surface environment to protect those underground sources of drinking water. So that's probably the biggest risk that is identified and addressed in the permitting process. And we could talk a lot more about what permitting is required and monitoring, but essentially it's dealt with.
And as we think about the energy, I often find that the full economic analysis, we don't really talk about that equation sometimes.
Right.
But as you think about the science of capturing carbon, transporting it, injecting it, maybe keeping it down where you want it to be, and you think about the energy that it takes to do that, pretty clear in your mind that the benefit is worth the energy expended?
Right. And the simple point that follows your statement is that to put a carbon capture unit on an industrial facility, you need extra power to power that unit. And so so really what you're talking about is something we refer to as life cycle analysis. And all life cycle analyses really are defined by what we call the boundary conditions. So where do you want to draw the boundaries of your system so that you can actually do an evaluation of what those inputs and benefits are, right? And so for most of the life cycle analysis done on CCS, there's a net benefit to the atmosphere that is affordable. Let's just put it that way. And so yes, it costs energy, it costs money, but it's providing a benefit that's probably not attainable in the near term other ways. And so is it a good investment? I would say yes, given that the other opportunities we have for decarbonizing are pretty difficult.
If you think about the economic cost of carbon,
right,
and the benefits of removing carbon and the cost of doing all the work, to you it makes sense.
Yeah.
Present value is probably positive.
Right. And so this might be an opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about what economically is driving this, because we're talking about essentially disposals. So, you know, in my prior landfill example, we all pay every month to have solid waste taken to a place where it's managed, you know, appropriately. And so ultimately, the way we manage carbon emissions will be added on to our costs, right? But on a per unit basis, so say your tires or your electric bill, on a per unit basis, it's going to be very low because we are a lot of people. And so that's one benefit of having that many people is you can distribute the costs out quite a bit. So it will cost money. But right now, the economic driver is there are lots of policy implements, right? Like the country of Norway decided they would implement a carbon tax. If you emit CO2, we will just tax you on a per unit basis. And industry there said, well, it's cheaper for us to put it in the ground and monitor it for safety than it is to pay your tax. So I'll do that. And that project has existed for now 24 years, mm-hmm. very successfully. So that's one method. In the United States, we have gone more towards what I would call the carrot approach, which is a carbon tax credit or a tax credit. So back about, at least back in 2008, 2009, the ideas were to put in place a carbon credit. And so it was priced at about $15 a ton. Well, the cost to capture carbon is way higher than $15 a ton. So it really only drove entry into the market for those industries that could capture carbon really cheaply, like ethanol or gas processing. But you didn't see a lot of growth because at $15 a ton, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for new entry, right? But in the meantime, bipartisanly, over a period of, you know, almost 15 years now, we've gradually increased that price point. And so now that credit is at $85 a ton, and that exceeds the cost to capture, transport, and store CO2. So now you can actually see a net financial benefit of doing a carbon capture, transport, and storage exercise. And that carbon credit or carbon tax credit is not, it's basically a foregone income from the Treasury, right? So on your IRS bill, if you owe a certain amount of money, if you've generated a certain tax credit, you can apply it to your tax liability. This is very similar to how we developed wind and solar so efficiently in the United States. And so originally you saw, and this is a great analogy, because in the early days, solar was very expensive, right? I mean, 30 years ago, nobody would have thought to do it at a reasonable cost, right? It was way too expensive, which is what everybody is saying about CCS right now. But because of the economic mechanisms that were put into place, external private capital came in, built projects, economies of scales were learned, costs came down, and now the cheapest electron you can generate is from a solar panel. So that's an incredibly successful process. So the cost came way down. So in CCS, the tax credit will work the same way it did in wind and solar, which is to basically say, let's get projects going, let's get our learnings, let's start to work on economies of scale, and the cost will come down so that this will be routine in 20 or 30 years.
Is carbon capture such that you think coal could continue to be a useful fuel for power generation?
I think, you know, when you put carbon capture on any energy source, it's really kind of a penalty on that energy source, right? It's making it more expensive. But I think the reality of coal, at least in the United States, has been that it's been in decline for decades now. And part of that is just the abundance of natural gas, right? I mean, when you can build a new power facility with natural gas, cheaper and generate, you know, power cheaper that way, then, and it's also lower carbon, then there are a lot of incentives to displace coal with natural gas. And so I think carbon capture is perfectly, we have an example. In the largest coal-fired electric utility in the country is outside of Houston. And that project captures CO2 from one of their facility, and it's a coal-fired electric utility. So we can do it. It's just, will it make sense to continue to build coal generation when you could do other generation like natural gas? The other thing that's interesting about that topic from my perspective is that you can also, there are turbines out there that will, you can co-fire ammonia in those turbines. Right. You can co-fire hydrogen in those turbines. So you've got a whole fuel set that's basically naturally displacing an older fuel set. And it sounds a lot like natural transitions from, say, you know, historically you go from wood to coal to liquid hydrocarbons, and down in the bottom corner of that is hydrogen. And hydrogen gets you the ratio of carbon to hydrogen as you go from wood to coal to gases, including hydrocarbons, propane, ethane, all the way down to methane, CH4, one carbon, four hydrogens. When you go to hydrogen, you've got two hydrogens, no carbon. So there's a very natural attractor point to move towards methane and hydrogen as fuel sources if the carbon content is of interest. So it's they're not only more efficient fuels, they're actually lower carbon fuels as well. So there's a lot of reasons to see this transition happening. But at the same time, coal is very cheap, and it's also one of the most utilized substances for generating power on the planet. Right. So probably what we'll see is coal utilization moving to other places when it's displaced in say the United States.
So let's go back to the Gulf Coast for a second, because there we're beginning to see e-fuels.
Yes.
Begin synthetics to at least synthetic fuels, where we actually take a pure stream of hydrogen. Now we bring in that carbon stream that you've sequestered and have no idea what to do with, and now we make a storable, transportable, more usable fuel like renewable propane.
Right.
You see value in that?
Yeah, that's to me that's fascinating, right? And that's one where the energetics, like you were describing on the boundary conditions, that's one where the energetics get away from me personally, because it depends where you're getting your hydrogen, right? So you can get your hydrogen from multiple sources, but then if you're going to go ahead and recombine it with, say, some carbons and other things to make those kinds of things, where are you getting those products, right? And if that makes sense to get the, if they're not being used otherwise, like we'd love to use CO2 in e-fuels rather than stick it in the ground. That's a much smarter use, right? So we'd love to see expansion of that, because ultimately, even though my job is to make sure we can store it safely at the volumes and masses that we need to achieve near-term goals, what we ultimately would love to see is, as I said, a more of a transition to diversification, reutilization, and, you know, generation of more utilization of CO2 for other things.
Yeah, we're excited about that. And again, I look at this excess of captured carbon that we might have one day, and then how do we use it?
Right. I think what's exciting to me is that for the same reasons that industries historically located next to each other, you'll see that being reinforced with the CO2 part. So as soon as, say, like we have very exciting work going on in the Port of Corpus Christi. It's the biggest energy exporting port in the United States. They're very aggressively pursuing hydrogen and CO2 capture. I've been helping them with how to plan that for their port and all of their port industries. And once you get that in place, it will tend to reinforce itself by other industries wanting to move in to take advantage of that. So you'll see ammonia facilities wanting to put themselves next to wherever the CO2 is. You'll see maybe these e-fuel companies wanting to move and put themselves next to that source of CO2. So it actually ends up also being an economic driver in some cases. When you start to get it, more people want to figure out what to do with it.
Right.
But we just got to start getting more of it.
Fascinating what's going on around in and around Corpus Christi, right, between LNG export and now right, we have hydrogen and carbon capture and pipelines, yeah, that work.
So I guess I started going to Corpus just a few years ago, and I was interested in, of course, that's the ports are where a lot of concentrated industry emissions are. And so I started wondering how ports could actually help facilitate this whole activity, because they know all of the players in their ports. They know what their needs are. They know what their strains are. And they know what their long-term goals are for the port. And so I started recognizing that ports were a huge opportunity. And so I started visiting them. I started with Port Arthur 8 years ago and then Corpus a few years ago. And now we have a DOE-funded project to look at CO2 storage onshore at Corpus and offshore at Corpus. And offshore, to me, is an incredibly interesting opportunity because it takes the CO2 storage into scales that start to really matter for, say, entire ports. So if you can provide a CO2 storage solution in state waters offshore Corpus, it's a real win for everybody, because the port benefits by decarbonizing. They attract other additional industries. The royalties and revenues from injecting into this Texas state waters go into the permanent school fund to fund primary education throughout the state, which is historically what the role of hydrocarbon extraction did for the state lands. And so you start to see that there's actually really creative ways to create lots of wins in the circle. And once more people see that and see handles into how they participate in that, you'll see more interest in wanting to get involved in those projects.
For all of this to work, the carbon accounting, if you will, needs to be relatively accurate.
Right.
For carbon taxes to work, for all the mechanisms that say this is worthwhile, this isn't worthwhile.
Right.
The arduous task of understanding where carbon came from, where it's going. Is that science sound today, carbon accounting?
Yeah, the accounting is new, I would say. It's got a long way to go. I made reference to something I referred to as sort of the AAA, right, you know, sort of quality of storage.
You said a couple of important things. All carbon's not the same.
Right.
I mean,
it's very difficult. So I think that accountability side is really starting to present itself quite strongly. So everyone is taking second or third looks at the way that they're approaching their offset. Their carbon offsets, or the way that they're trying to account for it. And so one thing I like about CCS is you put a meter on the wellhead and you can actually measure exactly how much CO2 went into the ground and is not going into the natural environment.
Right.
That's a very simple process. And so if you monitor it correctly and demonstrate that it's permanently stored, it's a pretty simple process. You measure it at the wellhead, you monitor it, and then if your well is it maintains its permit, you get to fill in your IRS tax credit form. But when you get into all these other areas, it starts to get very squishy. So, I mean, there's AA, there's single A, there's other types of credits or offsets out there. And I think this is what is the biggest challenge for the CO2 market, if you want to call it that, is that to turn that into a commodity that can be traded, marketed, et cetera, it really needs a price.
Right.
And I think everybody has said that the credit is great. It gets things going. But ultimately, we need a price. And frankly, that's what's stalling things at the global level, is that in the Paris Agreement, the negotiations about how to create a carbon dioxide market for the globe is making many countries very uncomfortable, because they don't necessarily feel like they're ready for that.
Right.
And so it's hard for some of those countries to enter into an agreement in, say, Article 6 that says we're going to have a new carbon market and then we're going to trade carbon, or we're going to have you know, trade balanced on carbon now. We're going to add a whole nother element to the game, so to speak. And some countries just aren't comfortable with that right now. So that's what's slowing down the international conversation, but they're making a lot of progress. And I think one day we will see CO2 traded on the open market globally like we do LNG. And there will probably be spot market prices, and ships will be moving CO2. There's ships being built today to move CO2 around the North Sea and in greater Southeast Asia. You can buy that ship today, and it's one of them is almost complete for the Norwegian project. And so within a matter of 5 to 10 years, these ships are going to be moving around from port to port, collecting CO2 and taking it to wherever it's most efficient to dispose of it. And that could mean spot market pricing, where you move from one storage allocation to another. You might have fixed contracts. You might have spot market things, just like we do for LNG. But to get to that point is really challenging, right?
So, fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
Fascinating. But clearly a key driver to the success is that you do have a tradable, and I guess as I see it, maybe the developed nations might have a price, and the developing nations may have either a separate price or even perhaps a different credit.
Right, and I think the opportunity for the developed nations is to develop technologies that can then be deployed globally.
Right.
And that's actually very similar to the LNG story, right? So there's a lot that can be done in the next 5 years to facilitate what we'd like to see is the developing countries to start building carbon capture into their built right. infrastructure, whereas we're trying to retrofit it. They should be planning and building it in from the beginning.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Meckel, it's time to have a little fun. We like to have fun with two questions. One, we have the magic wand, and it's amazing. You know, we're somewhere into podcast mid-80s, 85.
Oh, wow.
The magic wand answers are some of the most fascinating answers that we get. But I'm going to take a moment. I'm going to give you a magic wand. And with that wand, you can use it to change one thing in the next year regarding your source of expertise. So let's talk about regarding climate change, sustainability. I'm gonna give you a second to think. How would you use your magic wand?
I'll come right back to price. If I could wave that wand and create a carbon price that was built into all the diverse parts of the economic system where we currently don't account for carbon, if we build that in and price it correctly, I think a lot of people think that there's a trade-off to, you know, it's like, well, if you want to address carbon, your economy is going to suffer. And I think that there's actually ways to avoid that. And there's examples that suggest that we can avoid that. So if I could wave my wand, we would be at a part in the future where that is all priced in and is all distributed at low amounts so that we're not penalizing ourselves economically. Right. We're still developing. We're still benefiting from all these great societal things that we enjoy. And yet we've got a way to handle it. I guess it would, when I was young, I would travel to Mexico or Brazil, and I'm just picking them because I happen to go there, but you could pick any country. And the way they handled solid waste in the 80s was radically different than the way we did.
Right.
And it was rather shocking, right?
Right.
And so I think in my magic wand scenario, it will be as shocking to see a CO2 molecule go in the atmosphere as it is to see some trash thrown out of a car on a highway today.
Great use of your wand. Let me just follow up. Would that price be set by economists? Would it be set by scientists? Would it be set by politicians? Who sets that price?
I think I would lead with industry helping. Mm-hmm. They know what it takes. They know what costs it was. We didn't end up at $85 tax credit by accident. Mm-hmm. It was signaled.
Something about the benefit of the avoided cost, don't we?
Yes. And so, you know, in the government side, if they include social cost of carbon in their calculations, which is a highly contentious topic at the federal level, you know, every administration, if the administration changes, their position on incorporating the social cost of carbon in government calculations changes as well. And I think that sends a very unfortunate, noisy signal to industry.
Yeah.
And so what industry is saying right now is, at this tax credit level, we will continue to work on this, but we would eventually like to see a price. And some of the biggest industry proponents out there are suggesting even a straight up tax they would prefer. And these are very large companies that have very vested interests in all of this. So you'll see that it's probably that price signal is probably best captured by the ones doing the work. I think one of the things that the public really needs to absorb is that there is a cost for addressing carbon emissions. This is one very effective way to do it. And if you do not want industry to pursue this technology, they will turn away from reducing their emissions at all and say, we tried, you didn't like our option, therefore we're going back to what we were doing before. I would really hate to see that, because I think they can do so, so very much. to eliminate those emissions.
In the news over the last month or two has really been full of big name acquisitions in and around this area,
yes.
Massive investment following in. And if you were to kind of characterize it, it's major oil companies making major investments.
Right.
But do you think this is a game that's going to be played out by the majors with their infrastructure and their huge teams of people, or will it be done by entrepreneurial people who see a different way to do something?
So it's interesting you say that, because I see both happening today. So in our research group, we work with industry sponsors, and we also see a lot of project development at all levels. And right now, it's like the dinosaurs and the mammals. And I don't mean dinosaurs in a pejorative term, just in terms of size. You've got these very large energy companies that move at a certain pace and can change their momentum in certain ways, but it's hard to change turn a cruise ship on a dime, right? And then you've got all the mammals, the smaller companies that are out there scurrying around trying to acquire the pieces of the assets that would make for this chain of industry. And then you're starting to see already the amalgamation or the concentration of some of those assets. And so I think you're seeing both happen at the same time. I'd like to see a lot more entrepreneurialism in various parts of the CCS value chain, capture, transport, and storage. I think the areas for most innovation are going to be in the capture side and in the storage side. Mm-hmm. That's where entrepreneurialism can really come in. Transport is a little bit harder to see where new game-changing technologies might, you know, really come in. We're not going to build pipelines a whole lot bigger than we do today. Mm-hmm. So like a chance to make a jump in scale is hard there. But yeah, we're seeing a very interesting environment where the large energy companies are starting to make their moves, and you've already got some others out in front of them that are doing things, and there's a whole lot of them out there. But you're probably going to see a lot of consolidation over the next 10 years.
Yeah. That's what I would have expected you to answer. And I think that's the logical way to do it, is that it's going to be a mix.
It's what always happens.
At the end of the day, the solutions have to come from the scale of the integrated oils, but the ideas and...
And I think that's the thing that the public really needs to understand, is that to address that problem of emissions is a scale of activity that really only a few entities are capable
right.
of even doing,
right.
right? And so to ask somebody else to do that is unfair
right.
and really stupid, honestly. So of course they're going to do it, but they're going to need their own support basis for starting into it, which is what we have now. So I really want the public and the critical thinkers out there to understand that this is a way to get things started. And yes, we're going to do it through a tax credit initially, but as I said, we've done it for other industries in the past, and eventually it's going to be built into the whole process.
I do think one, and we sit here in Texas where we clearly have a different view, but I mean, there is a view that the oil companies put us in this mess, they should be penalized, they should be written out of the
right.
solutions, when in fact, the solutions are at such scale, only they will be able to execute it.
That's right. If you put them in an adversarial position on the topic of carbon capture and emissions abatement, as I said, they will turn away from trying to make progress.
Yeah.
So if the public decides that sticking CO2 in the ground is so dangerous that we shouldn't do this at all, I fear that we will not address this problem in a time frame that we really care about.
Right.
And this could be a real problem. And so you've got a lot of finance and a lot of talent stepping in on this right now. And I really would love to see the public think critically about it and say, yes, this is actually going to have a true positive impact. It's not just a reason to extend hydrocarbons, because after all, we need tires in the future, even if we have electric cars. So I think the public tends to think that all energy industries just produce gasoline and we burn it for transportation. But basically, almost everything in our built environment is coming from
right.
different energy chains. So if you ask that person in the public, tomorrow morning, go through your kitchen and see what you would be doing without those products. Those
right.
and I think that's where the public will realize that this isn't just about, you know, big oil and gasoline. This is about all of the products that we use very mundanely in our lives. And if you eliminate them, There's no replacement for it. You can't make tires out of it.
You cannot eliminate them.
You cannot eliminate them. So I think everyone sees CCS as just a way to extend rampant use of fossil fuels, when in fact what it's saying is, actually, we'd like to use them in a more responsible way with regard to emissions to the environment, which is not unlike what we did with SOx and NOx or dioxin in paper manufacturing or other things. We're just saying, let's address that now, and that can actually continue. And one thing I'll point out, the largest investors that are interested in CCS are institutional investors.
Right.
These are not just private banks and financial companies. These are institutional investments like pension funds for entire states who are saying, we are already invested in all of these facilities that generate these products. And if we don't have those facilities, not only do we not have what we need for our pensions, we don't have the products. So they're seeing CCS as, yes, a backstop to their entire pension investment. Right? And so when I went and looked at, you know, what my pension is invested in, it's not too surprising. There's a lot of IT, but there's a lot of energy in it too. And so I think if people realize that this is so embedded in the economic system in the world, that if you try and displace it radically quickly, it will lead to very uncomfortable results that they will react to. And so I don't have a doubt that we're going to end up in the right place. It's just I would like it to be a rational discussion that makes measured progress.
Fascinating
time.
Conversation. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. All right, you're a native Texan.
Yeah.
A lot of tradition here. Mm-hmm. So when I come to the national forest question, I'm always trying to anticipate. But in honor of your time with us today, your expertise, great conversation on this topic, We enjoy planting a tree in your name,
okay,
in a national forest.
All right.
And the only thing you have to do is pick the forest.
San Juan National Forest in southwestern Colorado.
Ah, once again, a surprise. There you go.
Yep.
San Juan National Forest in Colorado.
Yeah. And you know, I love the topic of trees. It's interesting. You know, you'll talk to people who say, well, shouldn't we just plant more trees? And my first response is, when was the last time you planted a tree?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is usually, I haven't. And I said, well, then go plant a tree. And you can plant trees, and I really appreciate the offer.
Well, I think you'll be tree number 86.
All right, tree number 86. I'd love to know where it ends up.
We will look forward to doing that. I cannot thank you enough for being with us today and talking about a topic that really just a couple of years ago really wasn't in the mainstream, but over the last month or two has certainly been a key topic.
We are at a turning point, I think, on this topic, and for a lot of reasons.
Dr. Tip Merkel, Senior Research Scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology, University of Texas in Austin, and Gulf Coast Carbon Center. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.